Today, it is awfully easy to ask the wrong question.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
So choose that topic, the wrong question, because we ask very often the wrong question. And it's worth figuring out why we do that and learning to ask the right question. There's one way I could take this, completely unrelated to what I actually want to do, which has to do with how politicians answer questions, and unfortunately also how I often answer questions. Because when I'm in a class, I have, I've been teaching for 25 years now. In higher education, I'm talking about. And when I'm in a class, I have a certain agenda. I have a topic that I need to cover. I have content that needs to be covered before the end of the semester. So I know where I'm taking a classroom. So I've learned over decades how to convert anyone's question into the topic I want to talk about. I've just learned how to do it. And that's not because they ask the wrong question regarding them. That's because they ask the wrong question regarding the topic I want to cover with them. That's a completely different problem than what I want to talk about. I mean, our tendency is to run straight from where we are standing to the immediate question in front of us and think that from that point, we should be able to move better, you move forward in a better way. Everything should get better if we just get an answer to this question where we are right now. But very often, our question really isn't the one we need answered. We need to know something completely different than what we're asking. And sometimes, to be frank about it, sometimes it's because we're lazy. We want a quick, easy answer to whatever's going on. Hey, how do I live a better life? That's not a great question for a lot of different reasons. So the way this comes up for me is actually through, I have an affinity for astronomy. I have since I was a little bitty child, 3 years old. And it wasn't developed then. I'm not saying I was a scientist at three. I just mean I know that I was at least interested by then. The first time my parents took me to the McDonnell Observatory, I don't even know if I was three. I was something preschool. That's what I was. So I assume it was around 3 years old. Since then, I've loved astronomy. And now, because I had grown older and gotten a bank account and had a little bit of money in it, it's like, I'm getting a telescope. So I got a telescope. This was 10 years ago now. And a little more than 10 years ago now. And, I've been doing on a regular basis, and regular just means when it's dark and the skies are clear and the moon's not out. And sometimes when the moon is out, because I can look at planets, whether the moon's out or not and so on, then I get my telescope out and I look at the sky. Or if I can't get the telescope out, just get a lawn chair out and stare at the sky and look at the things that are happening in it. And it's a real privilege to see something of that grandeur in your own backyard or wherever you are. It's just pretty magnificent. So anyway, I love the whole night sky venue. Is everything about it is just fantastic. And so I've gotten more knowledge as an amateur, not like a professional would have, but more knowledge of telescopes and the things that work best if you want to look at this or look at that, and the kinds of mounts you need to have and all that kind of stuff. And for that reason, because social media is apparently able to watch you in your sleep and figure out what you do or don't know and put that into your feed and have people ask questions, I see all those questions from people. Hey, what telescope should I get? And so the example I'm giving is that question. Which telescope is best? Which is not a stupid question. Don't get me wrong. That's not a stupid question. There is probably a best telescope for you to get. That's fine. And that's all a person means when they're asking the question. So again, don't confuse what I'm saying with someone being foolish or asking a stupid question. It's not that. It's just the wrong question. So in this case, when I say this, which telescope is best, if you've asked someone that or you've asked me that, I'm not really being critical of you. I'm saying, well, let me give you a better way to ask the question and to think about it. You say, what, we're talking about telescopes today? Briefly, because I like them and because they provide a great example of what I'm talking about. But then we'll get to the stuff that actually matters. So hang with me, if you don't mind, through this part of the conversation. It's just you being my friend. And you're like, I'm not your friend. Pretend for a minute. It's you being my friend. Let me talk about something I really enjoy talking about for a few minutes. So I see this question frequently, and again, I get it in personal emails. I get it in texts. I get it through social media. But normally, I'm getting it from a stranger, and it's because they're in social media, just asking generally. Hey, somebody out there, tell me what the best telescope is to buy, and then it just goes to all these people who. Enjoy the question and enjoy talking about it. And so what I find, I thought the most ingenious answer I found to this question, which is related to what I'm talking about today, wasn't my answer, somebody else's answer. I saw their answer. And what they said was, okay, I appreciate your question and I'm going to help you. But asking that question is a lot like saying to someone who you've never seen before without any other information, hey, which street is the best one for me to take? Where are you going? I don't know. How am I going to know which street you should take if I don't know where you're going? That's what happens with telescopes. They're all completely different. They all have a different value to them, and they have a different purpose to them. So the first telescope I bought, because I did a lot of research and because I asked the question, which telescope is best? And literally, that's how I started in my search. And then went through all the process of disaggregating that into more specific questions that I needed to answer on some cases and that other people needed to answer for me in other cases. Anyway, the first telescope I got was a Newtonian reflector, and that I still have it. It's a 10-inch Newtonian reflector, and it's a fantastic telescope. 10 inches doesn't mean 10 inches long. It means it has a 10-inch aperture. The primary of the objective mirror or lens is usually what you're talking about when you give the size of a telescope. It's how much light can get into the telescope from the sky. And so aperture, when you're talking about telescopes, the normal thing that people say is aperture is king, meaning the size of the opening. So it's like you're trying to catch as much light as you can, because that's the point, not magnification, but catching light. A lot of objects in the sky are really big. They take up a lot of space in the sky. You just can't see them because they're so dark. And so what you need is something that catches a lot of light and then obviously brings it down to a point of focus at your eye or the lens or the camera or whatever it is you're bringing it down to. So anyway, so I bought a Newtonian reflector 10 or 12 years ago and have loved it ever since. And it's fantastic. I can put it out on a dark night and see some really faint objects if after my eyes adjust and all that kind of stuff. Or I can put a nice camera on it and give it a good period of time to capture images or an image and see even fainter objects through this telescope. I love the telescope for that reason, because I can see really dark things in it. The disadvantage to it, there are a couple. The disadvantage to it is, number one, there's a thing called coma, which, again, I'm not going to stay that long on telescopes, but just give me a minute or two more, maybe five. A coma is, on a telescope, coma is this blurring of things at the edge of the image, toward the edge of the image, which can be really close to the center, as a matter of fact, where things look elongated as you get out from the middle of it, and it's built into a Newtonian reflector. They're called Newtonian because Isaac Newton invented this kind of telescope. You put a parabolic mirror in it, and it focuses all the light that's coming into that mirror that's right on the axis of your telescope, meaning directly in front of your telescope. It focuses all that light on a single point, the point of focus. And so you can see a really cool image, and you can get a lot of light focused on your eye. which would also just blind you if you pointed it at something super bright, like the sun, which it does to people all the time. Anyway, the point is, that's their fault. They shouldn't have done it. They get warnings all the time. Anyway, the point is, coma is all the stuff off to the side is a little off. So if you look at a deep sky image, there are all kinds of stars off to the side. So images look kind of rough, except for dead center. Dead center, they're bright and clear and perfect. But on the edges, they get pretty rough. And so you buy things to correct that, and you spend a lot more money adjusting it and blah, blah, blah. But it's never quite perfect because of that. The other thing I was just mentioning, by the way, that's not perfect about it is that if you point something with a big aperture like a Newtonian reflector at something bright, not even the sun, just the moon, I've done it 100 times. You can't see anything else for the next 10 minutes. It's so bright when it hits your eye. And so you really want something different than that, or some kind of a filter if you're going to look at something that bright. Anyway, so it's got advantages and disadvantages. I could go through other examples like a Schmidt-Cassegrain telescope, which great because it has a long focal length, which makes it great for looking at planets and things like that. But it's also really expensive compared with the aperture size you get. And it's kind of hard to maintain sometimes for some people. I'm not saying you can't figure it out, but collimating it is a challenge. Collimation is a big thing with telescopes. You have to, if you have mirrors in a telescope, you've got to make sure they're aligned exactly correctly, or the light will be all wonky and you end up with weird colors or things that aren't centered together and so on. And by the way, they're really heavy, which is a disadvantage if you're trying to set up somewhere in a dark sky and carry everything in a backpack or something. And then there are refractor telescopes, the kind you're used to seeing, the kind, you know, the pirate would hold up to his eye and stretch out and look across. It's just lenses of glass that are bringing the light into focus on this nearer point. And they are fantastic. They give clear images. You never have to collimate them. And you say, well, there's no disadvantage to that one. That seems like the perfect telescope. They are super expensive per the amount of aperture you're going to get from that telescope. So, you know, a 10-inch refractor, I'm just laughing thinking about it. I mean, I can't even imagine how much it would cost for a decent one. Plus, you have to do all these things to consider how many lenses it actually has and how that works with the light to keep it from discoloring things or creating some chromatic aberrations in what you get from it, which you really want a nice, clean image. I mean, that's the whole point of having something as good as a refractor. But, I mean, seriously, you'd probably spend $50,000 to get a 10-inch refractor. I mean, it's really expensive, and that's without all the setup that would go with it. I don't know that. It's not like I've researched it. It's way above what I would research. That's like thinking. Anyway, I'll leave it there. The point is, one of the better answers to the generic question, you know, which telescope is best, is you go through and explain to people, well, do you want to look at planets, or do you want to look at the moon, or are you wanting to look at the sun during the day, or are you wanting to look at stars at night, or are you wanting to look at deep sky objects like stars but nebula instead, or are you wanting to look at the galaxies, or how wide a field do you want? Do you want to take a picture of the Milky Way at night? That's a completely different kind of setup, and you wouldn't need a telescope at all. So just explain to me what it is you're looking for, and I'll help you get what you want. And then if they explain it, oh, well, what I'd like is a planet or blah, blah, blah. Oh, well, then this Newtonian reflector, you know, 10 inches, but it's also 35 pounds just for the telescope part, not the counterweights, not the mount, or any of the other stuff that goes with it. And then it's like, man, it takes an hour to set up. Are you really going to put that out in your yard every day? So the one answer I've always been most encouraged by, I'm about to leave the topic of telescopes, believe me, although I can't believe you're not just fascinated by it. And in fact, I assume you are and will want more. Just let me know. Anyway, the point is, the best telescope, and this is the best answer I've ever heard for it, the best telescope is the one you'll actually use. And so that's what you really want to know. So part of the answer also just involves how much work are you willing to do to set up, and how heavy a thing can you lift and put on a mount and use on a regular basis? Because if you never use it, it doesn't do any good at all. It doesn't matter what quality it has in the box. It has zero quality in the box. It's only worth something if it's pointed at some light that you're trying to see. So the one you'll use. And in truth, by the way, the telescope is very often, if you're going to do photography especially, less important than the kind of mount you get, because you need something that's rock steady, doesn't move with the wind, and also can track perfectly and doesn't twist as it's tracking. And you could get an azalt mount, it's called, azimuth and altitude mount. I don't know, azimuth, altitude, I think that's what that stands for, azalt. Which is, you know, basically just point it at the grid in the sky you want to look at, or a GEM mount, which is German equatorial mount, that's based on pointing at the North Star. And then once you get it pointed at the North Star, allowing this RA and declination axes to just rotate with the planet so that you can compensate for the rotation of the planet and stay focused completely on a star and not have any field rotation at all. It's a fantastic mount. But a lot more expensive, a lot more difficult to set up each time you do it, too, by the way, and so on. My point is, the mount is super important. So if you don't ask the right question, you're not going to know any of that stuff. You say, you said all of that just to say that? Yeah, but I love telescopes, see, and I love astronomy. So you were helping me today, and I've got a big smile on my face because I got to talk about it. So let me give you some examples of wrong questions that are a little more, you know, up the alley of the kind of stuff we talk about on a regular basis in this podcast. Well, you know, so an example would be this, and I get these a lot, because not only am I in ministry, and I've been in ministry since I was 16 years old, but, you know, I'm in higher education, which I've been in since I was 37 years old, I guess. And I love all of it. I love it. But I get the question all the time about, you know, which, so, And sometimes people will say it this way. What they really mean is about themselves. You know, what's the best job? You know, that kind of thing. But the way we think of it in almost every context I've ever been in is the way we think of which role or which job is most important. You know, who's in charge here? Take me to your leader kind of question. Who's the main guy? Who's the person I can really get things done with? You know, that kind of person. And we express it not necessarily as a question, but it is in this assumption that we're making where we would still be saying the question, you know, who's most important around here? Which job is most important? Which role is most important around here? It comes out in the expressions I hear all the time from people who are not being intentional about it. I've said it before. I still say it sometimes. But it implies this. Well, there are the really important people, and then there are the discardable people. You know, I mean, they don't even matter at all. And our way of saying this, ironically, is to try to say the opposite. So you say, oh, it doesn't matter who you are, from the president right down to the custodian. Every person here is important. If you just think about what we just said, you know, we just said the opposite of what we said. You know what I mean? We said, oh, they're all of equal importance, but we chose the one who was most important in our mind and put them at the top of a list, and then said, and right down, because we had to go way down to find this non-important peon of a person, you know, right down to the custodian. We implied that the one person is so much more important than everyone else. And I say president because I'm at a college, and I hear people use that term in that expression, by the way, fairly frequently. I heard someone say it just last week. But I heard it in churches exactly the same way. Oh, we're all in this together, from the pastor right down to the person that's mowing the grass. Oh, well, I mean, obviously they're not important, but we pretend they are. That, you know, that I'm not just trying to talk you out of that expression. I try not to use that expression because I realize the implication that's built into it. Most people I know don't take offense at it. They're not going to respond to you and say, how dare you say I'm unimportant by saying I am important. You know, none of them, people are not going to argue with you about it. But it is revealing something in our heart of hearts, within the recesses of our minds, that person really isn't important. But look how good we are because we pretend that they are. We act as if they are. And I want to challenge that from the actual basis of that premise that we have, that some are just more important than others. And I especially want to challenge that in terms of the way we think about ministry, and especially because of my tradition in ministry, the way we think about pastors. And I am a pastor. I've been a pastor. I'm not currently in my church serving as a pastor, but I have a background of being a pastor. I don't have anything against pastors. In fact, I train pastors, and I try to encourage pastors every opportunity I get. I focus my ministry on how to serve pastors because that's what I used to do, and that's what I sort of have some knowledge about trying to help with. So don't get me wrong. And don't get me wrong, pastors do deserve respect. I'm not at all. In fact, this whole concept is not about saying stop respecting people. It's about saying the opposite. You know, let's recognize that we shouldn't be respecters of persons. And you hear the difference in those two ideas, right? I mean, in Scripture, God is no respecter of persons. Doesn't mean he doesn't care about people. It means he doesn't regard one as being more important than the other. The way that comes out in the book of Leviticus, for instance, in the 19th chapter, the sort of center of that holiness section in Leviticus, is by saying you can't offer biased judgments, neither for the poor or for the rich. The point is you can be prejudicial either way, but if you're prejudicial at all, it's an unfair regard for every human being's worth, which puts them all in the same place. So I'm not suggesting that we not respect someone. I am suggesting that our respect be distributed better. So for instance, with pastors, the idea that we should respect them is built into passages like in Hebrews 13, which is the easiest place to point this out. Hebrews 13, in the 7th verse, it says, "Remember your leaders." And he's talking about congregational leaders because he's saying they spoke to you the word of God. So remember your leaders, those who spoke to you the word of God. Consider the outcome of their way of life and imitate their faith. All of that, by the way, coming nicely from the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus is talking about how we're supposed to be able to identify the people we follow, and it's by the fruit they produce. You know, a tree by its fruit. So it's a really nice passage, and what he's saying is you ought to respect your pastor. You ought to respect the one who's guiding you in the pasture, in the place that is the congregation, because they're demonstrating the thing that you're supposed to do. And in verse 17, it actually uses the word obey. Obey your leaders. It's not like we have an egalitarian society where nobody can tell anybody what to do. It is true that we should be egalitarian in our understanding of our worth with each other and so on, and maybe even a lot of the roles that can be held. That's fine. You can have that argument and discussion. But the point here is that you do have some people who hold an office that requires you to listen to what they say and actually follow it, obey it. So in verse 17 of Hebrews 13, it says, "Obey your leaders and submit to them, because they're keeping watch over your souls as those who will give an account. Let them do this with joy and not with groaning, for that wouldn't be any advantage to you." So the idea of respecting your pastors makes perfect sense. But if you put it in perspective, including in Hebrews 13, by the way, but I want to take it to a different passage because it's more emphatic in 1 Peter 5. If you put it in perspective, you don't respect them differently than you respect someone else. You respect them because they're leading you to the other things that ought to be true about you and about everyone else. And so, for example, in the case of the elders in 1 Peter 5 or the pastors, it's not the same word, but the same person in 1 Peter 5. So I exhort the elders among you as a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, as well as a partaker in the glory that's going to be revealed. This is Peter saying it. He says, I exhort you to do this. He's speaking to the elders. Shepherd the flock of God that's among you, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but willingly. So your job is not to stand up there and just because you have to or because it's the job and the only thing you can do. That, I think, is most likely what's going on there. But willingly, instead, you should do this as God would have you, because he's called you to do this thing. But don't do it for the gain you're going to get. Do it eagerly, not domineering over those in your charge. I'm the pastor. I get to tell you what to do. Not like that. Not domineering over those in your charge. You have to do what I say because I have this position. But being examples to the flock. That's not the only point I want to make. That's an important point, though. There is no just lording it over other people in the way the New Testament describes our roles because you have an office. You have the office because you have the ability to guide them in a way or serve them in a way that someone else doesn't have the ability to do, doesn't have perhaps the maturity to do. So in verse 5, likewise, you who are, he goes on to say in verse 4, I'm sorry, when the chief shepherd appears, then you'll receive the unfading crown of glory. What? Because you were pastors and they weren't? No. Just because you were faithful to the thing you were called to do. So likewise, you who are younger, be subject to the elders.
Oh, that says they receive a special respect.
Listen, clothe yourselves, all of you, with humility toward one another, because God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. The point in this whole section is that we don't have the prerogative of saying,
the pastor's more important.
He has a specific role that he needs to fulfill, and we respect him because of that role that he fulfills, but he also has the obligation to respect those who have a different role, even the ones who are in that role immature, younger, who have not arrived at the things he's arrived at already. That idea that some people are more important than other people in any part of our thinking, in any place where we think we could substitute the value of a person because of what they bring to some equation of relationships, is nowhere to be found in the morality that's given to us in Scripture. There's just not room for it. It's why people get confused when you present to them the kind of moral dilemma that you have in an emergency room. You know, a policeman and a criminal are brought in, and one of them is going to die because you can only operate on one, or you only have the resources to save the life of one of them. Which one are you going to save? Well, obviously, the policeman. That's not how you answer that question. You can't base it on what you think makes one of them more important or more worthwhile than the other one. That's not how human life is evaluated anywhere in Scripture or in any decent moral system. So the example that I would give you to just sort of base this and say, stop asking the question, who's most important here? You know, who's at the top? And again, we don't say the words as much as we think the concept. To get out of that, let me just give you a grounding in part of the Judeo part of the Judeo-Christian ethic that we carry. In other words, from an Old Testament example, in 1 Samuel 30, and I doubt I even need to read the whole thing to you, but I do want to make the point. In 1 Samuel 30, David, so I am going to read this little part of it to you, if you don't mind. Starting in verse 21, I didn't hear you say you minded, so I'm going to go ahead and read it to you. So then David came to the 200 men. So, you know, David's wives, he had two wives by this point. That's a problem, but whatever. He had two wives, and they were kidnapped. They were taken away by a group of people, and they were fighting at the time, Amalekites, I think, who had come, and they'd harassed the Philistines, and they had harassed the Israelites at the same time. And so they took some of David's people away while they were out doing something else on a campaign. And David comes to discover this, goes and chases down the Amalekites and wins a great battle with them, recovers everyone alive, takes all the stuff back. And then when they get back to 200 men who had been with David and his whole group of mighty men and warriors and so on, all the people who were following in the wilderness, 200 of them were so exhausted when they got back to the village that had been harassed that they were too tired to go chase down the enemy and get back the goods. And so they stayed behind. They stayed with the stuff. That's the language that we know from the King James, right? So David came to the 200 men who had been too exhausted to follow him and who had been left at the brook Besor, and they went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him who had fought in the battle. And when David came near to the people, he greeted them, and then all the wicked and worthless fellows. Now, that's a harsh description for people who've just been in a battle, a very significant battle, to get back your own people, to get back your children and your families and your stuff. And yet he calls them wicked and worthless because of what they're about to say, which is not an entirely unreasonable statement. But it is wicked and worthless if we adopt the morality that Scripture has about things like this. So it says, then all the wicked and worthless fellows among the men who had gone with David said, because they didn't go with us, those 200, they were too exhausted and stayed behind and didn't fight in the battle, we will not give them any of the spoil that we've recovered. They're not even being unfair about it in most of our minds, because they go on to say, I mean, obviously each man can lead away his own wife and his children and go back and live their life. We're not telling him he can't have back his own family. Of course they get their family back, but they don't get the stuff. We went and fought for the stuff. They didn't. And David said, "You shall not do so, my brothers, with what the Lord, Yahweh, has given us." We didn't get it because we fought. Yahweh gave it to us. Our fighting wouldn't have won if it weren't for him. So it's his gift. He has preserved us and given into our hand the band that came against us. Who would listen to you in this matter? For as his share is who goes down into the battle, so shall his share be who stays by the baggage. They shall share alike. And in the last verse in the little section, verse 25, this is in 1 Samuel 30. And he made it a statute and a rule for Israel from that day forward to this day. It's recorded for our benefit so we would know it. It became a law in the land so we would understand it, that we're not going to treat some people who do some things as if they're more important than the other people who do other things. That's not how we're going to live our lives in obedience to Yahweh. And why is that? Because we recognize it's all from Yahweh anyway. It's all from the Lord to begin with. It's not anything about me that puts me in one position and you in a different position. It's stuff about the Lord. Even if it's about me, like, oh, I like to speak. Did you figure that out yet? I like to speak, so I do this role. You don't like to speak, so you do that role. That may be something about my personal care. Where did I get that? I get it from God. You say, don't blame God for how much you like to speak. Fair. Fair point. We'll talk about sin and fallenness a different day. That's not the point for today, so just back off. Anyway, the point is, it's so important because it changes how we treat other people. That's why we have to have things like this in mind. And how, you know, because, look, I experienced this when I was in India. A couple of different times I got to go to India with a group of people who were much more engaged there, and they knew the whole culture better, and they led us around and helped us serve congregations who were over there, and then also a lot of sick people. There were some medical people who went. And so I was really blessed by that and grateful for the opportunity. Anyway, when I went, I had a translator and other friends who helped. I was in a different group than most of the rest of our group most of the time. And so I was around no other English people, no other Anglos at the time. And what I saw was people who loved the Lord. They really did. And they were much more committed to their discipleship than really anybody that I know, because they faced persecution on a regular basis. I mean, these people would chase people down to witness to them, knowing that they might be thrown in jail for doing it. So they're pretty aggressive about their Christianity, and they're pretty bold about it. So no complaints about the quality of their discipleship, okay? I'm pointing out something cultural and something real about the problem of thinking that some people are more important than other people. If you don't know anything else about India, I'm sure you do know that it was built on a caste society. The idea of different castes, different levels of people who were at the top level much more important than the people who were at the bottom level, the untouchables at the bottom level and so on, and all the levels in between. And everybody deferred to that. Well, the caste system is now defunct officially in India, but it's still very much a part of the mentality and the culture, at least the parts of the culture I was around. And again, I'm not trying to judge the whole country. I was just around a handful of people. But the ones I saw who were least likely to be that way, because they were really committed to their Christianity. And, you know, it's a primarily Hindu culture and then Muslim behind that, and Christian last of all, unless you're on the West Coast, you know, whatever the West Coast there is. I've forgotten the name of it now. Anyway, the ones that I met, really fine Christians. I was walking out of a place with them, and somebody had helped us with our bags and put them in the car and got them all loaded up. And so I talked to them for a second. Oh, man, thank you so much. I really appreciate your help. And they looked at me kind of funny, but they accepted it and gave me a head nod, actually a hand nod, and then went back in the place. And my translator looked at me and he said, "Oh, you don't want to do that. They're not people we talk to, you know." And I didn't even argue with my translator about it in the moment. I did question him about it, you know, why it is. And he talked about the caste that they would have been in, but also just the fact that in their culture, that wasn't the appropriate thing to do. Now, I'm not trying to question their whole culture, and I'm not saying that they were bad Christians. I'm not saying any of that. I don't know all the other story behind it. Maybe there's something else that people really don't want to be pointed out for the service that I have no idea about the rest of it. I'm just saying when you have a view of some role that it's actually more important than other roles, then it changes how you treat other people. It changes how deferential we are. I mean, think about how employees are to their boss or vice versa. It changes how we treat people. Think of how some husbands are to their wives. It just changes how we treat other people when we think, oh, I've got the really important role, you don't. And it also changes how we think of ourselves. When we think we have the more important role, somehow or another, we manage to give ourselves some credit for arriving in that important position. Even if we're just prosperous, we ignore all the dependencies that made that possible, how dependent we were on a culture and society that could promote prosperity, or even the specific legacy that handed down opportunities or giftedness or literally wealth from one generation to the next to get to us. We just look at the people who don't have it as if there's something lesser about them. And we tend to do the same thing with the importance of the role that we have. Well, my role is super important. Well, you don't have the merit to have a role as important as mine. Why don't you sit over there under my footstool? You know what I'm saying when I say that from James, right? So you get the point I'm making. And if I were to shift this a little to the side, and instead of saying it in terms of, you know, who's most important here or what's most significant here, we said just gifts, just talking about gifts of the Spirit. You know what I'm talking about in the New Testament kind of language. In terms of gifts, we run into the same kind of problem a couple of different ways. I'm just going to mention this and glance off of it and move on. But we do it. We do it with the question, you know, what's my gift? As if I've got some specific gift in me, and that's the thing that I can give to the congregation, and that's what makes it important, is that I have it. Rather than asking the more important question, which is, what can I give to this congregation or ministry that they need? Not, what do I have that's so important that they need to conform to fit whatever it is I'm going to bring because that's who I am? Not that, but where's there a gap? Where's there something missing in this congregation, and can I fill that? Am I able to fill it? You're not able to fill everything. Not everyone can do every role. I'm not saying that. But I am saying the Holy Spirit knows what he's doing when he puts people together in a congregation, and he puts us in a congregation so we will see what other people need and fill that need. That's what we do. We serve one another. The right question isn't just what's my gift, but what can I give to the congregation? And if you read those passages about the giftedness that we have in the Holy Spirit, in the congregation, that's what it's about. It's defined by what the people of God need in a given context. Or if we were saying to one another in a slightly different tone, which of the gifts is more important? And here I'm not even going to talk about it in spiritual or non-spiritual terms. Let me just put it the way we think of it. Well, which gift to this congregation is more important? The one the worship pastor brings, who's able to stand up and lead the congregation in the hymns, and he's able to select what songs will guide people to the foot of the throne, you know, that kind of stuff. So, and I'm not saying that's false. It's absolutely true. There are people who can do that, and it's a glorious and beautiful gift. Or is it the AV operator who, when he does or doesn't move the slides so that you can see the words on the screen, basically determines whether anybody's listening to the worship pastor anymore? Each role is equally important because you can be just as distracted by one as the other when it's not being done, and it is just as important whether you recognize the value of the person who's doing it when it is being done. My point is that which gift is most important is the one that's being used for the benefit of the body. That's the point. And it's the same thing I'm saying about whatever role it is we would regard as being more or less important in life. Let me give you just a couple of more examples, and we'll wrap it up, and I'll keep these much shorter. You know, one, here's a question that's the wrong question. How can I get people to follow me? Now, we wouldn't say it in that language, but what we mean is, how do I become a leader? How do I become a great leader, you know? And leadership seems to be the thing, you know, we want to follow. I'm for leadership. I believe in leadership. I think it's hugely important. I'm glad people get degrees in it. That question, if we were to rephrase it to what I think we actually mean by it, is how do I get a huge following? How do I get people to go where I'm telling them they ought to go? How do I get people to follow me? which is, by the way, equivalent, if I'm not talking in terms of leadership, to the question, how do I get people to pay me? How do I make more money? Or how do I get people to respect me, to treat me the way I think I deserve to be respected? Now, obviously, I'm making this obvious. Those are the wrong questions. They're not what we should be asking. The fact that we can ask it more subtly doesn't make it more right. So, you know, just take and apply it to the way we actually do think about it. And so I put it out there in three categories: leadership, how do I get people to follow me? And then vocation and career, you know, what's the job I should be pursuing? How do I find the right job? Or interpersonal relations, how do I get people to respect me? And for people pleasers, as they call themselves, I'm not judging anybody. That seems to be a really troubling question. How can I get them to like me? What can I do to make sure that they actually approve of me? And it's the wrong question every time. For the leadership question, it's wrong because basically, and I see this all the time, because I'm the president of a college where people commit to ministry, and a lot of people go into ministry because that's where they see people stand in front of a big room and have everyone stare at them for a while. Oh, look, I can get a lot of people to listen to me. And I have people say, well, when am I going to get up in front of the big room? You know, I want to speak in front of that room. I got an email from a student one time saying that. So how do I get in front of that room? I can just see myself in front of 1,500 people in that room, you know. And I thought it was really odd, first of all, because we don't have 1,500 people in the room when we're speaking in it. But I get it. He has a vision. Oh, I have a vision of accomplishing something great. How can I get in front of that big room? Or for a job, you know, how do I get an important job? Not just a nuts and bolts job, but an important job. Which, by the way, for half the people who ask me that question in one way or another, what they really mean is, how can I get a cushy job? How can I get a job where it's so important I don't even have to do it? which is a weird goal. But man, do I know a lot of people who have that goal for their job. And in interpersonal relationships, it's how do I get people to like me? You know, what am I supposed to do? And those are completely the wrong question. If you just think about it in terms of what we were saying earlier, you'll understand what I mean. On the question about leadership, it's not how can I get people to follow me? It's where should I be going? Where should I be going? Where am I supposed to be going? And if anyone were to follow me, how would I know that they're going to get somewhere worth going if I haven't answered the question, where should I be going? So I ask, where should I be going? What should I be working toward myself? So that if anyone ever were following me, we'd get somewhere that was worth going. The question for the job, you know, my vocation, my career, how do I get an important job? How do I get what we should be asking is not how do I get paid? How do I get the big job? How do I get a place where I can be more comfortable or something like that? We should be saying, what can I do well enough that my involvement would actually help people? Or would actually further a cause that's worth serving. If you want an important job, that's what you really mean. What can I do that actually helps people? And that might be under a house. I mean, it could be anything. But the question is what you're doing that actually does help people or actually does serve a purpose that's worth serving. And if it's about the interpersonal relations, like we were saying, you know, how do I get people to like me? The better question would be, well, what lies in my power to be that person's friend? Not to get that person to see me as their friend, but for me actually to be a friend to that person or to be reconciled to that person. Not because they reconcile to me, but what lies in me, in Paul's language, you know, to be able to reconcile to that person. Not, do they like me, but what can I like about them? That was a really interesting thing about, I told you about this a while back. I think I mentioned it on an episode about Jack Pogue, who passed away a couple of months ago now, that every person who came to him, I put it in a little eulogy that I wrote about him, but every person that came to him, very often, they were trying to get something from him. And he was no fool, and nobody ever pulled anything over on Jack. And so when he when they would come to him, they would, you know, try to talk him into things he wasn't going to do. And, you know, a lot of times people are car salesmen-y. Not that there's anything wrong with car salesmen, Well, talk about contradicting myself in the episode. Anyway, the point is, they came across as the caricature that people unfairly offer of a car salesman sometimes, as insincere, you know, like, oh, let me get you in this one. You know, I'll get you in this one. Oh, a little old lady drove it to church once a week, and it only had it 2 weeks, you know, so it's a brand new car practically, and so on. It was like that. And with Jack, I saw it over and over again. People would sit and talk with him, and they would suddenly turn to trying to manipulate him into some kind of gift that they wanted to get, instead of just being straightforward. Hey, I want to do this project. Love for you to be involved in. It's going to be this much. When people did that, it was fine. He would just say no, you know, and then it was over. So they'd try to be sneaky about it. And there's no sneaking with Jack. And, you know, none of us really appreciate people trying to sneak around and get something from us. And he didn't either. But every time he talked to me about somebody like that, and it was not uncommon, every time he talked to me about somebody like that, what he would say about them is, but you know, I really kind of like the guy because of this or that. He would say what it was that he really valued about what they brought, which he told me he learned, by the way, from Dr. Criswell. So I really respect him for that, and that's in our power. It's not in my power to make other people like me. It is in my power to like other people. And as it turns out, there's a side benefit to that, but we won't get into that right now. You say, what's the side benefit? You know, he who would have friends must show himself friendly. It actually does come back. There actually is a return on that investment. That's not the goal. It's not the purpose, but it actually is there. So last, final question that's wrong, and this one will just take a moment. You know, when we say, what's wrong with those people? Why would they do that kind of stuff? So there are a bunch of things I could share about this, but in my life, I've learned that when we're asking that question, all it means is we're not paying enough attention to the things that need to change in us. That's what it comes down to. And so the question I would always ask us, I asked this the other day when we had a small turnout at some event we were doing, and I could tell people were a little uncomfortable, And so I just basically put to them, you know, so suppose the room was completely full. Just imagine it. Close your eyes and imagine the room completely full, shoulder to shoulder. You barely got a seat in the room. For how many of those people was God going to hold you accountable regarding their holiness? The same number of people, you have the same responsibility for the same number of people in the room right now that you would have had if it's full. The point being, you know, I could ask you the question this way. Is there anyone living outside of your skin that God commands you to make holy? No. And that doesn't mean no one depends on you. There are people who depend on you. You have responsibilities for other people. This doesn't undermine that at all. But what it does mean is that the only path you have to anyone else's holiness is your own. That's the only one God has given us. The question is never, what's wrong with those people? The right question is, what's wrong with me? And the answer is never about fixing them, but instead asking God to fix me. So, if you want to replace the question with the right question, I'd suggest we replace the question with a prayer instead, the right prayer. And the right prayer is, like a telescope, the one you'll actually use, you know, the one you'll actually make. The one that, you know, as Jesus gives it to us, makes today about his name, kingdom, and will. And the one that puts our need, not everyone else or whatever's wrong with them, it puts our need in his hand, our lack, our deficiency, our problem in his hand. Not what's wrong with everyone else. And because that prayer changes us, it puts everyone else's need right where it should be to us, regarding us, to begin with. It should be in God's hand. Where, by the way, once we ask the right questions, he can also wield us however he wants.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.